Well, hi, Kim.
Hi, Ken.
How are you today?
Good. I think it's cloudy outside, and I think it's affecting my mind.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is your mind kind of cloudy?
It is a little cloudy today.
Okay.
Maybe it's because it's towards the end of the week. I don't know.
Yeah, that'll happen. As we're recording this, it's a Thursday, just to put a
yeah, but I guess that could apply on a Monday, too, huh?
Yeah,
anyway, moving
yeah.
right along.
Moving right along. We have a pair of guests on the line right now through the miracle of conference calling. And we're here to talk about a book entitled Making Peace with the Land, God's Call to Reconcile with Creation. Kim, who do we have on the line?
We have two gentlemen calling in. The first is Norman Wurzba. He is a research professor of theology, ecology, and rural life at Duke Divinity School. Welcome, Norman.
Thanks for having me.
Did I get all that right?
You did, and you got the name right, too. That's great.
Thank you.
How do people usually mess it up, Norman?
Oh, there's all kinds of ways, so we won't even get started.
Wow. All you have to do is look at it. It's pretty simple, actually. You know, Norman, where are you calling in from today?
I live in Durham area of North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Raleigh. Is it cloudy there?
No, it's actually quite lovely.
Oh, good.
So I'm pleased. This is the year, though, that winter forgot to come, so everything is green and warm and
really
happening. So.
Wow, good deal. Also on the phone, we have the co-author of the book, Fred Bonson. Fred is a permaculture gardener. Fred, what does permaculture mean?
That's a good question. I'm still trying to figure that out myself. it's sort of an ecological form of agriculture where you try to mimic nature's processes in the way that you grow food.
Oh, okay.
Sort of a shorthand way of describing that.
You are a permaculture gardener, a pioneer in church-supported agriculture, as well as an award-winning poet and essayist. That's interesting. Agriculture and the arts. You're kind of like a Renaissance man, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't know. That's probably too exalted a phrase for what I am, but I'm an unrepentant generalist is probably the way to describe it.
Unrepentant generalist. Okay. So, Fred and Norman, how did you two connect with each other on such a unique topic?
Fred, why don't you try?
Well,
anybody.
Probably 5 or 6 years ago. I met Norman when he came to speak at a conference at Duke, I believe. And at the time, I was directing a community-supported agriculture project for a small rural Methodist church down in Cedar Grove, North Carolina. And we sort of got to talking and got to be buddies. And over the years, I've read a lot of Norman's books and we've had a lot of good long conversations about these topics, and I guess 4 or 5 months ago, half a year ago, Norman asked me to co-write this book with him, and that's kind of the short story.
It is, and I think this would be a good time to point out, Norman, that you've written several books kind of around this same theme, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, the area that really concerns me or is sort of preoccupies me is how human beings, and especially how Christians, live on the land. And Fred and I think we're sort of charting new territory when we do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of church folks would not think that agriculture or food production are uniquely theological themes.
Mm.
But Fred and I think that they are important themes for the church, and we're trying to help folks see what that might look like.
Hmm.
And given that there are so few of us who are really interested in this topic, having Fred and us work together was a really good opportunity.
Well, it's a great opportunity for us to talk to both of you gentlemen today. It was probably, a week or two ago, we were talking about Earth Day being this month and how cool it would be to be able to talk to somebody who could give us a biblical or a godly perspective on Earth Day, because I have always been one who's been pretty big on that, and I love the smell of dirt and getting my hands in it and planting a garden. But you know, the information we were getting here through our email and what have you was not at all biblically based. So when we saw an opportunity to talk to both of you, it was quite exciting for Ken and I both. I think, huh, Ken?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think a lot of people in the environmental world are fairly suspicious of Christians for a variety of reasons. I mean, some of it is just historical, that Christians have not been very supportive. They've been slow getting on board with ecological themes. And part of it, I think, is because Christians are nervous that environmentalism is a kind of pagan or New Age type movement. And I hope that reading books like the one Fred and I have written will help people see that the Bible is very, very concerned about the soil. It's very concerned about all of the world's creatures. And Christians have a pretty important role to play in the health of the world and the health of communities together.
Fred Norman just brought up the point that folks in the ecological movement are kind of suspicious of Christians. How, in your estimation, how much of that is, do you think, the marriage of the American church wholeheartedly into the capitalistic system is, you know, let's go, let's pay paradise and put up a parking lot?
You don't want to get me started on this, but yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There is a lot within American Christianity that makes it very easy for Christians to think that all the faith is about is getting your soul into heaven, and the rest just doesn't matter. And so
it's all going to burn anyway, right?
American Christians think that it's all about doing what the American dream says, and when the American dream is very destructive of ecological systems, that seems to be okay. And Fred and I are saying it's not okay.
And this is actually one of the things I touch on in one of my chapters in the book. Norman and I sort of flip-flop back and forth. We each write a chapter and sort of riff on each other's. But in one of my chapters, I talk about what I call the abundant mirage, which is this this whole way of life that I think many of us have bought into, where our sources of energy, our food, just our the sources of our daily sustenance just seem to arrive from out of the ether. And it's really a mirage. It's not really based on reality. But yet it seems abundance. We walk into a grocery store and it's just filled with an endless array of choices. And we flip on a switch and energy just arrives in our home. But all of this is based on cheap fossil fuels. That's kind of what's driving our whole big economy, and we're seeing that that's quickly coming to an end. And so we need to think about how we can return to a much more grounded kind of abundance, which is the abundance that we read about in Scripture, you know, where Jesus feeds people, where he breaks the loaves and fishes. And I think as much as we can try to rethink where abundance really comes from, and mimic that in our agriculture and in our lives, I think we'll have a much more grounded, realistic life.
Now, I think it might have even been in that chapter that I read about you giving an assignment to some students to choose their favorite food and then follow it back to where it originally came from.
Norman, I believe, yeah.
Was that Norman that wrote that chapter?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Okay, so that was maybe a different chapter than Fred was talking about. But I really just had to kind of, it took me back. I raised children and I thought, gosh, what would my kids have said? And could they trace their favorite food back to the soil?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that the food economy that we live in is an anonymous one where there's a lot of blindness and ignorance. We just don't know where food comes from. And the reality is that especially if you're eating highly processed foods, which would be most of the food that's in the central aisles of a grocery store, the food companies, for the most part, don't want you to know where your food is coming from. Because if you learned the full story of what's behind many of these packaged products, you probably wouldn't want to eat them.
Well,
A lot of cruelty. There's a lot of degradation. It's not especially good for the people who eat the food, right? We're learning about the ill health effects of many of the foods we eat. It's certainly not good for agricultural workers, and we know it's not good for the animals or the soil or the water. So it's a situation where we, just by buying the food that looks cheap and attractive, right, we're daily contributing to all sorts of harm. And I think if we could simply get people to see more carefully where food comes from, the great cost behind food in terms of life and death and labor, that maybe we would make some different food choices.
Even, well, I had read just in the last week or two an article that somebody had posted, a link on Facebook, and you read the label of the products, and of course, if it's in a box, it's automatically suspect because it doesn't rot. It's not real. But even the concept of, quote, natural flavor, and the article that pointed out natural flavor, well, that could include things like, oh, blood.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those broad ingredient categories.
Yeah, it's natural. You know, dog poo that you step in, that's a natural ingredient, isn't it?
Right.
Well, or like the big Starbucks hoo-ha just a couple of weeks ago with what was coloring their strawberry beverage, those crushed insects or whatever. And I heard somebody talking about this, and they said, why don't they just use strawberries?
Right.
It seems so logical, and yet it's all mixed up.
Fred, you can only speak for you, obviously, but what point did you become very interested in the agrarian life?
I really would trace it, I would say, to two things. One was reading the work of Wendell Berry, who, if your listeners are not familiar with him, I would rush out and buy any of his books of poetry or his essays or his novels. But he really, Wendell is a farmer and a writer in Kentucky. And when I read his work in divinity school, I really saw sort of fleshed out and embodied a lot of the ideas that I've been reading about. And he really described a world for me that was very attractive, a life much closer to the land, much less dependent on the consumer economy, a life that paid a lot more attention to the community, both community of people and the community of animals and plants around you. And I really was attracted to that way of life. So I think reading Wendell Berry, and the second thing was going to live with a group of Mayan coffee farmers down in Chiapas, Mexico.
Oh, interesting.
A group of Catholic coffee farmers. And it was living with these folks for all of us of one spring back in 2001 that I really sort of saw lived out a lot of these ideas I've been reading about in Wendell Berry's books. And that drove me to want to learn how to grow food, and I got married. My wife and I bought a small farm, and then I ended up helping start a church-supported community garden and did that for 4 years and just really fell in love with that way of life.
That's a really interesting concept to me. I think about so many churches here in the Central Valley of California that they don't just have a building, but they have property. And how might that land be utilized to grow food, to donate? I think I read somewhere in the book about growing the food to donate to food banks and homeless shelters and things like that. How would a church get started with something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Norman and I each talk about that in the book. Norman actually describes the story of Anatoth Community Garden, where I worked and where he's been involved. And I tell some of the stories of some of the other communities that I've visited in the years since. And I think what we're really seeing right now across the country and even around the world is this cresting of a wave, or this rising of a wave, of especially people of faith, churches, really wanting to sort of reconnect with the basic sources of their sustenance. And that means growing food with their neighbors. Community gardens, church-supported agriculture projects, and I think community gardens especially is a really fun and delicious and community-building way that churches can get back connected to their sources of food. And there's just all kinds of wonderful benefits that start to accrue once you plant a garden in your neighborhood. You know, people just show up.
I think Fred and I would both sort of say that there isn't any one particular way that you're going to do this, because every community is different, every region is different, and you may have a church that's got a number of people who've got a lot of experience with gardens, and you'll do things differently than those churches that have almost nobody. And the thing is, I think to get a good sense for your community and for what you have available in terms of skill, in terms of land, and then see what you can come up with together, you know, starting small. Starting really big can be pretty daunting because gardening work is not easy. And, you know, Fred's a really good gardener, and, you know, he knows what he's doing, but a lot of other people aren't going to know what they're doing. And if you start too big, you'll just get frustrated.
So start small. That's a good beginner tip.
Baby steps. Norman, same question I asked Fred. What steered you in the direction where you have arrived today?
Oh, I mean, it's a long story, but I mean, the short way to do it is to say that I grew up farming in Western Canada and really lived in sort of the tension between industrial agriculture, which we now know to be doing a lot of harm, and a more traditional form of agriculture that Wendell describes, but I also saw played out in the church that I grew up in. You know, it was made up of a number of German farmers who had come to Canada, and they really subscribed to a tradition of agriculture known as husbandry, which means you make the care and the well-being of your animals and your fields a foremost priority.
Wow.
And it's not all about just making a lot of money or increasing yields at whatever cost. And so, you know, this was something that I grew up with but didn't really think was at the heart of theological or philosophical work that I was doing as an academic. And I think encountering Wendell Berry was a real insight for me in that it showed me that not only is this a compelling view of the world and set of practices and responsibilities, but it also goes to the core of Christianity. I mean, if you read the Bible, it's impossible for you to read very far and not come across agricultural realities, agricultural imagery. I mean, it's in the New Testament. It's certainly in the Old Testament. You can't make sense of Jesus if you don't know about plants, if you don't know about animals and the care of these. And then, you know, the big image that we try to develop in the book a little bit is that God is the first gardener, the first farmer. And Christians have overlooked that in the last 100 years because we've become so urban and so focused on immaterial things, when the Bible is, in fact, a book about how to live in this material world in a way that honors God.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Kim.
Thank you.
You're welcome. After you.
I was going to say, I read, I think it's either in the foreword or at the very beginning of the book, this idea of God being the original gardener. And you said in there that all life comes from the soil. And I love that.
Yeah. Well, and that's, if you've grown up on a farm, like many people throughout the world's history have, that's just an obvious point that, you know, you say it now and you have to think, how is it possible that we forgot this? But if we live in suburbia or urban life, it's very easy to forget our dependence upon the soil.
Well, it is. And I have to confess, I grew up in suburbia in Southern California. So even just moving to the Central Valley of California, I couldn't believe how ignorant I was to what are those orchards? What's in those fields? I don't even know what those things are. How can I tell that tree from that tree? I don't know the difference. I never had reason to even wonder, really, because of how I grew up.
The opportunity to wonder also means that we're not in a position to be able to know when we're destroying the very things we need
right.
to eat.
Right, you know. Right. Now, since living here and then working here, because we have about a 45-minute commute through the country, I've been blessed so many times by the things God has shown me, principles he's shown me, as I've watched these different orchards go through the seasons and the changes. But I've also been appalled at the times where we've passed by the orchards, particularly I think of the orange orchards, Ken, where the guys are out on their tractors at night with the headlights on, and they're in like this full hazmat gear spraying stuff on these orange trees, and it's repulsive.
And it's blowing out into the road as we drive through it.
Right.
It was heart-wrenching for me to see that, and I just saw that maybe in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
So it is, there is some ignorance out there. I'm one of those people who didn't grow up close to the land.
Ditto. I was a suburban kid from Southern California, too. One of you, maybe it was you, Norman, touched upon it at the beginning of the interview, but do you ever get turned down to come and speak somewhere because it's a church group and they're going, no, wait a minute, I think you're talking about hippie New Age socialist ideas, aren't you?
That's certainly the perception that a lot of people will have. They tend not to invite me to begin with. You know, and maybe Fred can talk about this himself because, you know, he goes around talking with folks about this as well. But I think what's encouraging to see is that more and more Christians are waking up to the fact that we're living in a kind of bubble of ignorance. And we can't continue to do that because we're getting, you know, just from the mainstream media every day now, information about how our food is being produced. And it's really concerning. And so we can't just, you know, stick our heads in the sand and pretend that nothing is wrong. Yeah. We know there's lots wrong if you start to look. And the issue then is not how do you get Christians to engage, but how do you get Christians to not simply, you know, close their eyes in despair? Because the problems are immense. They really are.
Maybe part.
What we're trying to do in this book is talk about how this is not kind of a special interest area. To have an environmental sensibility to want to make peace with the land is really part of our Christian heritage, and it's all throughout Scripture. And one of the things Norman does really well in his chapters is sort of develop kind of a Christological understanding of reconciliation with the land, and he uses Colossians 1, the Christ hymn in Colossians 1. He himself is before all things. Christ is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's the head of the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn of the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And here's the key verse. And through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven. So this idea that we're not just reconciled in terms of our souls, but that God, through Christ, has reconciled all of creation. And that has profound implications for how we live. And this is one of the things we try to work out in the book.
I wonder if one of the difficulties, at least with some churches, gentlemen, is a lot of churches, you know, they'll focus on the big sins in life, you know, this sin or that sin, or, you know, the ones I'm talking about are hot-button social issues, and deservedly so if they're spelled out as sin. But seems like if we put crap into our mouth and eat it, that's not really much of an issue, is it? You know, obesity is not really addressed, gluttony is not addressed, and, hey, let's all go out for donuts afterwards.
Right. I mean, it's ironic in a way, and even tragic, that Christianity, which talks so much about loving the neighbor, really doesn't care if the neighbor is living in a world that is so thoroughly poisoned that the water, the food, the soil, the air, all of it will shorten our lives, will put us in the hospital. And that seems not to have dawned on many Christians, that we can maybe love souls in abstraction, but to love the whole person, which is certainly what we see Jesus doing in the Gospels in his ministries of feeding and healing and touching and so forth. Right? Jesus addresses the whole person. And I think when you start to think about whole persons, you have to think about the food they eat, the air they breathe, the water they drink, the land that they walk on. All of these things become central to this message of love and redemption that Christ preaches and shows to us.
I see that one of the chapters that Kim had printed up on the page here, it was one of yours, Norman. It's called Honoring God by Manufacturing Food. Could you weigh in on that for just a moment?
Well, if you think about the way a lot of our food is manufactured, it's not about honoring God at all. It's really about trying to increase profitability, maximize productivity. And to do that, we're going to have to do a lot of things that are going to be either harmful or just destructive. And the question would be, what would we do differently in the way we grow food, in the way we prepare it, the way we serve it, if we saw our eating and our food production as a way to honor God? I think this is a profound opportunity. It's difficult to do when you live in a world like ours where the emphasis is only on cheapness and convenience, but if we think about how our eating can be the occasion to honor God, then we have to step back and look at the many processes that are at work in all stages of food's production and consumption. And it's a tremendous challenge, but it's also a tremendous opportunity, because when you do it right, you not only get to eat good food, you get to share it in fellowship with other people. And that's a wonderful thing.
Sure, and Jesus was very much about that kind of thing. He was often shown in Scripture breaking bread with this group and that group.
Oh, sure. I mean, one of the commentators on Luke's Gospel that I read once said that in Luke's Gospel, Jesus is either at a meal, coming from a meal, or going to a meal.
Well, there we go.
It's all about eating. And I think if people think about the really treasured memories that they have in their lives, I bet you food is at the heart of many of them.
Sure it is, yeah.
And you have that, you tell the story, Kim, of your loud Italian family sitting around the Sunday evening dinner table, right?
Yeah, because it's not just about the meal. We gather with our grown children and friends and whoever, and we often sit at the table for an hour or more after the meal's done and just enjoy one another's company. And we've talked about all kinds of topics. So it's amazing that, you know, conversation can grow from the soil.
But it's difficult to do in our culture that's been dubbed the fast food nation, right?
You have to be intentional.
People eat alone, and the conversation that is the heart of a good life seems to dissipate.
It's true. And with the electronic age that we live in, it's very simple to isolate yourself. But there's richness and beauty in the communion of eating together.
Now, Fred, I have not seen the entire book yet, but do you deal with the health issues in there? Because what I look at is basically the epidemic of cancer that we have in our society today. And I think, okay, maybe people didn't live as long for other reasons 150 years ago, but it seems to think cancer exponentially is rising because, you know, how many generations down the line have people been eating out of boxes?
Yeah, that's something we touch on here and there throughout the book. There's a wonderful book I can recommend on sort of the health aspects of eating called In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan. But one of the things that we, as you mentioned, that we're experiencing is all this increase in diseases, and a lot of that is directly linked to the way we eat. I've been reading some studies recently that indicate that possibly autism is linked to the petrochemicals in our food, from the fertilizers and pesticides. Up until, I believe it was last year, high fructose corn syrup was made with mercury.
Ice.
So, you know, all this stuff is just seeping into our food supply.
Wow.
And it's building up in our bodies, and I think we're seeing the deleterious negative effects of that. But the good news is that doing the right thing is also the tasty thing and the healthy thing. And so eating locally, eating fresh organic produce grown by your local farmer who you can get to know and talk to them face to face, or growing it in community with your neighbors at a community garden, shopping at the farmer's market, all these kinds of things, you can sort of bypass the whole big bad industrial food system altogether, and you can get your food, you know, much closer to the source.
And it just tastes so much better.
It really does.
Oh, yeah. We moved to organic several years ago for health reasons. And, you know, I cannot, if we go to a restaurant, I never order a salad. I can't even imagine eating the salad they would bring me because it doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, another sort of fallout of the industrial way of eating is that our the nutrient density in vegetables has steadily declined since the 1940s. With the rise of industrial agriculture, you know, you need a head of broccoli to be big. You need it to be able to ship and keep for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you lose as you breed for that is nutrient density and vitamins, as well as flavor. And so a head of broccoli is no longer the same head of broccoli it was, you know, 40, 50 years ago in terms of nutrients.
Wow.
And, but again, you can, instead of buying that industrial head of broccoli from Walmart or wherever, you can go get a good, you know, heirloom head of broccoli from your local farmer.
There you go.
And it will have that kind of nutrient density that you want.
Yeah. Taste that's noticeable.
The connection of our food with God and agriculture, and an interesting connection. As the gentleman said, you got to understand basically the agrarian lifestyle to understand much of what Jesus is talking about. The book is Making Peace with the Land, God's Call to Reconcile with Creation. Fred Bonson and Norman Wiersba.
It actually releases in May, is that correct?
Yeah, I don't know that it's hit bookstores yet, but my guess is that it should be showing up at, you know, local bookstores, Christian bookstores, and online you can find it as well.
I wasn't aware it hadn't been released yet. So,
So, I read the fine
so
print.
So coming
here.
Soon to a bookstore near you, I'm assuming it'll be available on Amazon, et cetera.
Sure.
Okay. Anything about the whole dirt concept, dirt and theology that we haven't covered here, that we haven't uncovered out of the dirt?
We all come from the dirt, and we're all going to return to that. I think we just read about that in the Bible recently.
Mm-hmm. I like to put it, we are glorified dirtbags.
All right.
You'll let me say it, right? All right. Fred Bonson and Norman Wiersba, look for their book, Making Peace with the Land, God's Call to Reconcile with Creation.
Thank you, gentlemen, both, for giving us a little slice of your time. It was enlightening. I'd love to talk to you again. As I understand, there's going to be a study guide to go along with this book, hopefully. Is that right?
Yes, it's included in the book right now.
Oh, it's included in the book. Okay. That's awesome. So you could get a group of neighbors together and go through this book.
While eating a good meal together.
Oh, sounds like a plan. What a great thing for people to do for the summer.
There you go.
You know?
Turn off the TV, get outside, hang out with the neighbors.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Well, Norman and Fred, thank you so much again for your time. God bless you as you continue to spread the word about this. It just makes so much sense to me. I really appreciate you both